accession number 30633, Mr. James Farquharson, Real 7. Now, we're talking about your time with 10th Light Anti-Aircraft Training Regiment at Deepcourt Camp.
Yes.
Now, if we look at a typical day, I think we'll be able to spin off a lot of the things we want to look at.
Well, the typical day began at about 6.30 a.m. With PT.
What type of PT? Jerks,
roughly speaking. Can't remember in the summer, but of course we were there right into the winter. And in the winter, when it was pitch dark, we had double daylight savings, so it went on. They didn't get daylight till around about 10 a.m. in the middle of winter. We did all this in a gun shed, an enormous metal shed with faint lights on inside. And I chiefly remember, you know, in a squad, everybody leaping, waving their arms or their legs in time and that sort of thing, with an instructor who always seemed very odd. I mean, his instructions were not particularly military. One of the words, hands on low hips, the fellow would say, always had rather dainty voices and were always incredibly tough. They could do absolutely anything. They could rush up and down ropes and goodness knows what. And we did that for about half an hour, something like that. Then when we were then dressed in, more or less in what at school would have been football dress, I think. I mean, shorts and a vest or something like that. But I really can't remember exactly what. Then we went back and dressed in our hut. Went for breakfast.
Now, what was the food like? I mean, you'd been used to public school food, to Harrow food. What did you think of Army food?
Army food was, I think, by the standards that had been adopted, arisen by then in the course of the war, extremely good, much better than the poor civilians got, because there was no noticeable rationing. You went into the... yes, it was the cookhouse, it was called. A large hall, in fact, and there was an enormous sort of cafeteria, would become later on, but great big dishes full of bacon, not very nicely done, because it was all swimming in tomato juice or something like that, and sausages. I don't think there were eggs. Anyhow, you helped yourself. You picked up a plate and took a pair of tweezers out and picked up what you wanted, and a spoon for the gravy. And moved on. You picked up a mug of tea, I suppose, went and sat down at a table somewhere. I forget if at that stage you had your own knife, fork, and spoon, but that was a great thing. They stuck out of your top pocket. You then ate your breakfast.
Now let's do the other meals as well. So, what might you get for lunch or dinner, whatever you called it?
I simply can't remember. I remember that breakfast very well. But the others...
But the food was generally plenty of it, and it was okay.
It was... I suppose it was okay, though, in fact, my colleagues, I mean, the sort of ex-public school people, used to go out together to a very nice little restaurant, that's what you call it, a sort of wooden hut across the road outside the barracks, where a good lady had... racks of stuff to make grills. I mean, there were lamb chops, sausages, goodness knows what, all along the back. And you went in there and you chose from her what you would like to have, and she would cook it all, serve it to you on a plate, and you paid for it, per item. Very cheap. I mean, the whole thing would be one and ninepence or something. And that very often was our form of supper.
So that was a local cafe, or sort of...
Can't think what you call it. It wasn't. There was no drink served beyond a cup of tea. It was. It served a need, certainly. I mean, we enjoyed that much more than just going and having the camp supper.
And what about after breakfast? Then going back into our day.
After breakfast, at a certain time, which probably was 9 o'clock, I guess, there was parade, and we all had to appear properly dressed, with properly polished boots and everything, all brasses polished, and. Form up in squads on the parade ground with our instructor getting us properly marshalled. Then the CO and adjutant, second in command, and people would come onto the parade with their swagger sticks and everything and stand around. And there was, of course, a regimental sergeant major, a fearsome character, who everybody intensely disliked. And he would call the parade to attention. And I forget what on earth we did then. I don't think there was a roll call. Yeah, there was a roll call, yes. I remember for a particular reason. The chap who arrived at the station when we joined up, he was a rebel. He'd been the head of the Communist Society at Cambridge. And he, Sam Boats was his name, and he had a girlfriend in Bournemouth or somewhere like that, and he used to telephone her every morning. And one morning he couldn't get through for some time, and so he was still in the telephone box on the edge of the camp when the parade began, and he appeared quite nonchalantly. I mean, he just walked and strolled across the parade ground, and I remember the RSM shouting out, that man, stand fast, or something. And he went over and addressed Sam Boats and stood him to one side. And by that time, he was reported missing, of course, from his squad. And I forget what his punishment was, but he was fearless. He did all sorts of extraordinary things.
So there's this morning parade.
The morning parade was followed. We then sort of broke up and went off in our own squads to do various things. Some would go to have a lecture on aiming a rifle, or naming of parts was the famous thing, or map reading and so on. I mean, it was all arranged so that the parade ground wouldn't be overcrowded, and a certain number would be doing marching drill.
Well, let's take that first. You'd done drill before. Was there anything you had to learn?
Oh, yes. I suppose I got the right attitude, but not very much more. It all seemed entirely new to me again. And, of course, one thing that had changed was that while in my OTC, we still marched in fours. So we formed fours and formed two deep. That was two of the regular drill movements. By the time we were in battle dress, we were in threes, and none of that happened at all. The only form of drill involved with the number of ranks was that if we were on parade lengthwise, I mean facing, not as for marching, but facing the square, we might be told to get what the order was, but you took two steps forward, the front rank did, and the back rank took two steps backwards to widen the spaces between, largely for the inspecting posse to walk between, I think, and look at us all. And of course, a great deal of things like right dress, whereupon we all flung our heads round and looked, and the man at the right-hand end kept his head facing forwards, and everybody then shuffled their feet and made as much nonsense of it as they could, shuffling and shuffling, trying to get into line. And the instructor's assistant, probably, stood at the end of the line, kept on saying, number two, step back, and so on. And not only that, but you then sloped your rifle, and there was a great deal of getting the rifles all sloping at the same angle, so somebody's rifle wasn't tipped over backwards more than all the others, and so on. Quite extraordinary, the fuss and bother about that sort of thing.
Did you understand the point of it all, the drill, or fussy drill, anyway?
Yes, I think we were conscious that we were being formed into a unit. There were wonderful moments. Some of the recruits were, in fact, quite elderly by our standards. I mean, I was 21 then. There were some who were younger than me, but a certain number were over 30. They seemed to be middle-aged, and also had, of course, been out in the world and had jobs. And they didn't take to military drill or discipline at all well, and were also sometimes very forgetful and dreamy. I remember so well there was a chap called Joey Eddy, who was always making mistakes and doing silly things. One day when we were on parade, we were all told to turn right, I think. He turned left, and he and I came face to face. And we broke down in giggles. We were both made to go and stand at the side of the parade ground to be dealt with later. on one occasion, I was put on a charge for doing that, I remember. The only time I ever went to orderly room, which was a bit farcical, because I remember that the officer who actually heard the case broke down in laughter as well, and case dismissed. But it was something I wouldn't have missed. All that went on. I suppose we had a break.
What about some of the other sessions you mentioned? What about weapons training generally? I mean, you'd done quite a bit of this.
There was an interval, after all, of about 3 years in which I'd done my best to forget all that. So that it was all fairly new. And we enjoyed it. I mean, we put our backs into it much more than many of the others. So that after, I forget how long, perhaps after 4 weeks or something like that, we fellows were all picked out. We were all made lance bombardiers.
Hang on, I'll come back. Tell me about the weapons training first, then. So what did you do?
Oh, it's difficult to remember. I mean, we learnt the rifle and also the Lewis gun.
And about bayonet.
Bayonet fixing, yes. And we did this stupid business of giving a scream and charging a hanging sack, which again was, we all made a joke of it, really. And our instructors were, they varied. Some of them were delightful characters, and there were one or two very ignorant sort of fellows who, you know, didn't really understand what it was all about, I think.
In what way? How did they show their ignorance?
They showed their ignorance, I think, by being unnecessarily strict in many cases and keeping on calling us up to do the same thing over and over again and that sort of thing, which was rather excessive. Whereas others, we got to know in spare time, of course, in the NAFI and so on, they became, in a way, friends. I mean, we were all in the same thing, whereas the other instructors, and there were very few of them, didn't join in the same way. But to go back to weapon training, yes, I think we fired on a miniature range.
So it's much the same as you'd done before?
Very much the same, yes. We certainly did all this cleaning and polishing, putting a pull through the barrel of the rifle, and one thing and another, and oiling things. And it was all second nature to me. I mean,
what are the training sessions? You mentioned map reading. Was that a big thing? Or
map reading was a big thing, yes. We had lectures on map reading. I remember one of the fellow students was a chap from the West Country, I think, and one of the things that always amused us was these conventional symbols for churches. If it was just a cross on the map, it meant that it was a church without any tower or spire. And if it was a building with a cross on the top, it was a church with a tower. And if it had a point on the top, it was a church with a spire. I rather forget which. One was a circle. That was the one with the spire, I think. Because I always remember, we always remembered one chap who, when he was asked what the symbol for a church with a tower was, he said, "A screw in a cross, interp."
Did you have practical map reading, or was it just theoretical?
I suspect we had practical map reading as well. We would have gone out on Blackdown Common or something like that, up the road. I think there was a stretch of heathland towards Camberley. I'm pretty sure we did that. Little exercises. When we were picked out and made lance bombardiers and formed into the potential officer squad, PO squad.
How did you feel about that?
Well, it's what I expected.
Was that what you wanted?
Oh, yes. I was always too thankful that, at least for a short period, I was in the ranks. I think those who went straight to OCTU, having been in a university OTC or something like that, missed a great deal and became a totally different kind of officer very often. much more the sort of guards type.
In what way was it beneficial in other ranks? I mean, what do you think it gave you an insight into?
Well, it gave you an insight to some extent, I suppose, into the attitude of the other ranks, but most of whom were extremely resentful at being called up and having their livelihood wrecked for the time being.
How did your training carry on in this potential officer's squad?
As a potential officer, we then had a certain amount of, I think, of special tuition, rather more extended than the ordinary chaps got, because, of course, they only did a month's training, and then they moved off to join regiments, whereas we stayed from July the 8th to January the 25th, I think it was, quite a long time. And we, in that time, we were very much cosseted in a way. On parade, we were the drill sergeant's assistants. We stood there, when marching, we said left, right, and pick them up and all that sort of thing. And we were, quite often, we were called into the CO's office. He was a wonderful man, Lieutenant Colonel Buckland, always known as Barmy Buckland, a dreamy old man, very old-fashioned, a regular soldier, and he used to give us general knowledge tests. Very amusing. We all just sat around on the floor and that sort of thing, and he would chat with us. And the thing that, again, particularly remained in people's memories was he would say, "What and where is Merv?" And nobody knew. And it turned out to be the crossroads, the meeting place of caravans in the, you know, around Samarkand and places like Turkestan or somewhere. And I don't know why, it must be something to do with Afghanistan or something. I don't know why he was so knowledgeable about that. And all sorts of other strange questions.
Now, one thing I forgot. Can you tell us about how you prepare for a kit inspection? This is probably a bit earlier, but can we do it now anyway?
Now, that I can describe in much greater detail in my OCTU stage, but there... another thing I'd forgotten to say was that when we were formed into the BO squad, we were then moved out of the barrack blocks and put into the disused married quarters, which are a curious little terrace of little brick buildings, very, very small, and there we were allowed to have suitcases under our beds. I remember well that because my cigarette lighter that I'd been given as a 21st birthday present was stolen by the quartermaster sergeant major, I remember.
You know,
I got it back. He was hauled up. He was dismissed or something. He was a chap who had a very idle existence. He used to go off to the races in the afternoon, and he would obviously lose money on the races and want to make it up by pawning people's goods that he'd stolen. He was called Hedges, I remember. We then lived in these married quarters. I can't remember exactly how they were laid out, probably about two people to a room. And there we had to polish our brasses and everything, and our boots, and I don't know what we did about kit layout there. I'm now jump back to the barrack rooms, where you had to pick up your three biscuits that you'd laid out to sleep on and pile one on top of the other on the end of the bed. You then laid on top of them your three blankets, very, very carefully folded so that nothing stuck out anywhere, and so that you showed three rounded ends to the front and no bits bulging out at the sides. And on top of that, you put ground sheet, or was it your gas cape? It must have been your ground sheet went somewhere. I think you had a gas cape as well, which was a very flimsy, thin plastic thing, camouflage. I think you had to fold that as well. And then on top of it all, you put your steel helmet. And in front, there must have been some sort of ledge in front, you then put your spare pair of boots. You were issued, of course, part of your uniform with two pairs of black boots. And you had to, one of the important things was that you always had to have proper nails in the boots. So people were always taking their boots to the snob, and he would pull out the worn ones and replace them. And if any of your nails were badly worn down, you hadn't done anything about it, you were in trouble, that sort of thing.
What about polishing your boots?
Polishing, yes. Now, that you were taught all sorts of weird ways of polishing your boots to get them perfect. And
what were they? How did you do it?
Well, as far as I remember, the popular way, I mean, there was no official way, I don't think, but people came and advised you, people who seemed to be experienced. And one of the things was that you put massive, it was principally, of course, the toe caps always that had to shine, and you put lots of polish on the toe caps. You then lit a candle or something and held the toe cap over the candle till the polish began to melt. And then you rubbed it in, and you rubbed and rubbed and rubbed with one of the, what you call it, a sort of chamois leather pad thing. And you went on rubbing and rubbing, spent the whole evening doing it sometimes. And I remember an awful thing I did, because you see, we had to be wearing one pair of boots that was respectable, and the other ones were on show. And I went and burnt out the toe caps, because I put the toe cap down too near the candle and partially burnt off the surface of the toe cap. And I forget what I did. The kit layout, the toe caps were not showing unless somebody picked the boot up and examined it. It was showing the soles with the nails on. So, in fact, I went on wearing the same boots, I suppose, all the time, as far as I could, and hid my guilty secret on my kit layout.
Any other? I mean, did they use... I mean, were they the buttons and the rest of it?
For the rest, the only brass or leather that we had then, you didn't wear a belt or anything like that. You didn't wear a uniform cap with a strap on it. So it was really only your greatcoat, as far as I remember. And that had to be folded in an extraordinary way so that you buttoned it up. And there were two lines of brass buttons down the front, and it was quite narrow, and everything else was sort of folded around the back. So it was just a sort of khaki strip hanging from, it can't be a coat hanger, you must have had something, or something special at the top. And all the buttons had, I think you bought yourself a button stick, you know, which was a sort of brass thing, plate with a slit down the middle of it, and you ran that under the button so that you didn't polish the khaki by mistake. And then you put your polish on the button, and it was the coat was protected by the button stick pushed through underneath. And then you, with a cloth, you went on polishing your buttons. And that was quite a lengthy...
Did you have to put anything on your webbing?
Webbing, yes. What was the stuff called? With a respirator in a canvas bag, which you hung on your front, on your chest, as far as I remember.
What about actually cleaning your room? I mean, was that rigorously inspected?
You know, I can't remember anything about that at Deep Cut at all.
Well,
we must have swept
did
it.
You, while you were at Deep Cut, did you with the 10th Light Air, did you do any gunnery training at all, as opposed to what you might call general military training?
Yes, I think we did. I think we did probably did gun drill. I really can't remember.
Gun drill on what?
On a Bofors 40mm AC-AT gun, which was the standard light anti-aircraft gun, and the only weapon, only gun, that light anti-aircraft regiments were issued with.
Do you remember anything about gun drill on the Bofors? I mean, what you were actually being taught?
Well, I have a much better memory of all this at OCTU. A few months later, and there, certainly you were taught drill on the gun. That's to say, your gun positions, your gun laying, as it was called, training in the garden.
I think you're right. We'll come back to this when we get to it. Any other anti-aircraft training that you did at Deepcoat?
I can't remember, but we must. I think it's possible we did some gun drill there, but there were Lewis gun positions, one or two around the camp, little gun pits made of sandbags, with a Lewis gun on a tripod in the middle, and they were manned at night always by us. I mean, we were in. There was a sort of rota again, and you did 3 hours or something during the night, and were relieved then. And they must have considered you capable of firing the gun at an enemy aircraft. It was very much anti-aircraft, but I don't suppose any Lewis gun would have ever reached any aeroplane flying over.
Anything else? Anti-aircraft training or
gun? I simply can't remember.
What did you do for recreation then? You know, I mean...
A deep cut. Blessed if I can remember. We might have done a cross-country run or something. Otherwise, it was... Yes. The PT in the morning, of course, was part of what you might call recreation.
I mean, like going out. Were you allowed out from camp for a
trip? We were allowed out, certainly, on Saturday afternoons. We were free. I forget if you had to get a pass or something to go out. You probably
what
did.
What would you do?
On the whole, occasionally, you got a pass to go home for the weekend. And it was very easy for me. I mean, you just went into Woking and caught a train to Salisbury, and I was very lucky in that way. It was about less than an hour's journey. But otherwise, we would generally go into Woking and go and have an evening meal in the Albion Hotel, which immediately outside the station no longer exists, I notice. And there, drink a lot of beer as well, and eventually get on a train back to Brookwood. That was our nearest station on the main line. And very drunk very often. I remember I was shouting down the corridor on one occasion, and a young officer came along, nothing to do with our unit or anything, and he shouted at me, "If you can't hold your drink, hold your tongue." And then we stumbled out of the train at Brookwood and trudged up to Deepcut. I forget how far, a good mile, I should think, and presented ourselves at the guardroom and checked in.
How did you get on with the other lads? I mean, you know, after the first sort of almost shock of the different works, different classes, isn't it?
Yes.
How did you get on with them overall during the whole of your time there? And I know later on you became just potential officers, but how did you get on with the recruits generally?
That's difficult to say now, because we separated ourselves. We became a clique almost at once.
So you didn't mix with
them? We didn't form any real friendship with any of them, I don't think. There were a lot of them who were very friendly, and we probably sat around in the naffy in the evening with a pint of beer. And there was a great deal of honky-tonk piano playing in the naffy and communal singing and things like that. We joined in all that, of course.
So the more working-class ones didn't bully you or try and bully you?
No. I don't think we were noticeably criticised or teased. It was part of life for them, I suppose. They realised that there were some chaps who were sort of marked out for higher things, shall we say.